This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. It's Michael Cruz Kane, and I'm back with another episode of A Good Crime. Welcome back, or welcome if you're here for the first time. I hope you'll stick around. We kick things off with what I like to call a grief thought. Today, I'm thinking about the questions I've asked you folks through the last episode, especially other types of grief that you wanted to hear about. And by far, the most common one was death of a spouse, which is what we're talking about this week. So to Thomas, Chris, Dave, Rhonda, Melanie, and all the people who asked for an episode on this subject, this is the first of what will probably be very many. But it really got me thinking about all the transactive memory that spouses have with each other, or, you know, any long-term relationship. And as I was playing this episode for my wife, we were listening to James Naughton talk, and she had me pause the episode, and she goes, "What's that song?" And I knew immediately that she was not talking about any of the songs that James Naughton sang on Broadway during his illustrious and what continues to be illustrious career, but rather about a song that James' son Greg used to sing called Stop the Night that we probably haven't listened to in over a decade for sure. But right away, I knew what she was talking about with no clues. Or I know, for example, when she says Ellen DeGeneres, the 6 different people who look vaguely like Ellen DeGeneres that she might be talking about. And to imagine the loss of someone like that, to imagine losing her or her losing me, all the shorthand you have, all the memories you have that fit together, you would never have anyone to have those memories with again. And I'm laughing. It's devastating, that thought. The idea of being disconnected from the thing you've been plugged into for however long. Anyway, today's episode is with the great James Naughton. He's an actor, a Broadway actor, a TV and film actor. I went to college for musical theater. Jealous. And he is a hero of mine as a performer. He's also a director. He is a voiceover artist, sort of without parallel, which you will hear immediately when you listen to him. And we talk about the death of his wife, Pam, which was a result of pancreatic cancer, and the journey that the two of them went on in the 4 years between when she was diagnosed and when she died, and how it inspired him to become the activist that he is today. In addition to that, he gives one of the truest and greatest quotes, which I'm going to butcher a little bit right now. The idea effectively is no one on this planet is more dependent than a husband. And I think that is very, very true. The longer that I am with my wife, the more that I depend on her for everything. This is James Naughton on A Good Cry. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps. Hi, James. Thanks for doing this. How are you doing today, sir? Are you all right?
Good evening. It's a gray, rainy, going to be freezing cold day. So we're in the right spot on a day like this.
I think that's right. Yeah. I can't get over, having heard your voice in many things throughout the years, still hearing it in person, it does feel, there's like a certain level of omnipotence in the voice that's hard to ignore.
Got to figure out how I can monetize that.
Yeah, man. If you need an agent for something like that, we can talk after the podcast.
Yeah, I have been known to do a few voiceovers in my day.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. So James, the way we get the podcast started typically is by asking a sort of open-ended question, which is, would you tell us your relationship with the grief? How would you describe your relationship with grief?
Well, my experience, which was really significant, was having my wife of 46 years die after 4 years of battling pancreatic cancer with her. In 2009, she was diagnosed after a doctor spent 6 months saying that he thought it was something else. And she finally, she had been to see her doctor, the gastroenterologist, because she had been being treated for lymphocytic colitis for some time, which is a little more benign than the other kind of colitis, an inflammation of the intestines. And she called me one day, and she'd been to the doctor, and I was out, and she got me in my car, and she said, they have discovered a mass in my pancreas. And I won't forget that feeling, because I knew that that was a very, very bad thing to have your doctor tell you. It was sort of like a shot to the heart. So I said, come on, I'll meet you at home. And we embarked on quite a journey for the next 4 years. She had a Whipple procedure at Memorial Sloan Kettering, which I'm told is a very, very complex surgery. It involves going in and cutting where your duodenum meets your intestines and your bile duct and your pancreas. There's this tremendous intersection of all of these different tubes. And they cut it, and they cut off the head of the pancreas, which is about the third of your pancreas, and they sew it all back together again and then hope that you heal well. And that takes quite a bit of time. In Pam's case, we spent that summer, she was diagnosed in April and operated on in May, came home, and she was doing all right for the first few weeks, and then her whole digestive system basically balked. And then they hooked her up with a port and an IV. And for 12 hours every night, I would hook her up to a bag that would feed her. And we would hang the bag up on a pole and watch TV at 8 o'clock for an hour or two, and then go into the bedroom and move all the paraphernalia. And at 10 and at 8 a.m., I would disconnect her. And without that being intravenously fed for a month, she wouldn't have made it, but she did. And she recovered very well, and things started to work very well. And she began to get chemotherapy. And then after that chemotherapy stopped working, she went to another chemo, and then another one. And after about 2.5 years of that kind of behavior, the doctor said to us that he didn't have another chemo to throw at it. He basically was out of options. And he said to me, there's a new clinical trial going on down in San Antonio, Texas. Give this doctor a call. Maybe Pam could get into the trial. And so I called. They wanted to see all of the paperwork, and the doctor sent them all that. And then they wanted to see her. So we got on a plane and flew from JFK down to San Antonio. When we got off the plane, it was August. It was 114 degrees and blowing.
Wow.
And it was like being in a blast furnace. And we went to the doctor the next day, and she got into the trial. She got the last place. And so for the next 8 months, every week, we flew to San Antonio, Texas. We flew down on the one nonstop per day each way. We flew down on Tuesday. She was treated on Wednesday, and we flew home early Thursday morning. We did that for 8 months, and then that trial stopped working, that chemo that she had been treated with. And then she lasted for about another 9 months or a year. And her friends would say, you know, she just keeps looking more beautiful. you wouldn't know that she was sick if we didn't know it. And that lasted for about 3 years. One friend said to me recently, she just kept looking younger and younger. Which, if you knew what was going on, didn't make any sense at all. But she looked good. And then during the last 4 to 6 months that she had, the disease really began to take its toll. She was on it at the end. She was on a pain pump. She was on oxygen. She developed a blockage in her bile duct, and they couldn't get into it internally. So they had to they had to operate on her and do an external drain, and then catch the bile in a bag on her side, on the side of her rib cage. And this went on for about 4 to 6 months, and she soldiered on, smiling through it all. Until one day she said to me, and it took me by surprise, I guess, she said to me, "Jimmy, I don't want to wake up anymore." And I processed that throughout the day. And that night when I got into bed with her, next to her at 11 o'clock or so, she woke up and she peered at me in the darkness and she said, "Oh, I thought I wasn't going to have to wake up anymore." And, I got to tell you that the feeling that I had at that moment was one of tremendous failure, that I wasn't able to wave a magic wand and help her out, because that's what she wanted. She wanted out. And she didn't last much longer, which was merciful. Sometimes people in this condition can go on for much too long. So that was the odyssey that we went through, and I took care of her basically by myself throughout all of that. I was managing the pain pump and the oxygen tanks and the bile duct bags and everything, and all the doctor visits and all the hospital visits, and that was. It'll be 9 years ago this April that Pam died, which is unbelievable to me.
Wow. Okay, obviously I want to go deeper into all of that, but before we go back, can you also tell us about some of the legislation you've been working on?
For the last 4 or 5 years, I've been really actively involved in trying to get Connecticut, which is our home state, to pass this medical aid in dying bill. So that people, when they get to that stage and they say, I don't want to go on anymore, have an option. It's a law that's been passed in 10 states and the District of Columbia, dating back to 1997 when it was first passed in Oregon. And now it is the law in California, Oregon, Washington State, Hawaii, just this past year, New Mexico, Montana, Colorado, 2 years ago, New Jersey, Vermont, and Maine.
James, what does that mean? What would the law allow for?
What the law allows for, and there are all kinds of restrictions and safeguards so that it doesn't get abused. But when a person is at the end and doesn't want to have to suffer anymore and can't really be taken care of with the palliative care that hospice and other organizations offer, if they get two doctors, the law requires two doctors to say that the patient has less than 6 months to live and is not just depressed. If that means that he has to have a psychiatric evaluation, so be it. And then you have to wait 2 weeks and then you have to go back and get the doctor to agree again. So there's a waiting period. So it's not just somebody who's depressed or wants to kill himself, and there are all kinds of safeguards so that that doesn't happen. And the thing that's interesting to me is because there are basically two organizations that have been fighting this legislation, both here in Connecticut and in other states. And the two organizations are the Catholic Church and people with disabilities. And the folks with disabilities, they say that they are afraid that they could find themselves in a position where they would be pressured by someone who might benefit from their death, an heir, for example. Now, in all of that time, since 1997, at the end of every year, the state of Oregon, for example, mandates that if there were such an abuse, that it would have to be reported. And if there were such an abuse, by the way, that's called a felony.
Right.
So it's a very serious infraction. And in all that time, in the 23 years since 5 years, actually, now, since Oregon passed it, there has not been one instance of that kind of abuse reported by the mandate. So I don't think that that's, I understand and I'm sympathetic to the worry that people with disabilities have, but there's a paper trail and there's evidence that that's not actually occurring. So I don't think that it needs to be worried about. It can be controlled.
And is the church concerned about like suicide? Is that the church's point of view?
Yeah, the church, I guess, has, they have their own, the Catholic Church has its own, there are other religious groups that are also against it. I think it gets into thinking about the sanctity of life, et cetera. But I have a couple of really interesting quotes that I'd like to share with you on that subject.
Love a good quote. Hit me with it.
Two very, very famous, thoughtful Catholic governors have talked about this issue. In 1984, Mario Cuomo, who was a really thoughtful Catholic governor of New York State, and what Mario Cuomo said in 1984 was, he said, in our pluralistic society, we create public morality through consensus. The arguments start when religious values are used to support positions which would impose on other people restrictions they find unacceptable. When should I argue to make my religious value your morality, he said, my rule of conduct your limitation, which I think puts it pretty well.
Yeah.
And another Catholic governor, Governor Jerry Brown, who actually was in the seminary as a young man, said in 2015, he said, I don't know what I would do if I were dying in prolonged and excruciating pain. I am certain, however, that it would be a comfort to be able to consider the options afforded by this bill. And I wouldn't deny that right to others. And I think that that says it awfully well. That's exactly where we are.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
75% of Connecticut residents want this legislation, according to the latest Gallup poll. And over 70% of Catholics want this legislation. So I think it's going to happen. The question is, when is it going to happen?
Right.
3 years ago, we failed, and I went up to testify in Hartford. We failed by one vote to get it out of the Public Health Committee and bring it to the floor. Last year, I testified again, and we got it out of Public Health Committee by a vote of 24-9, and it was a bipartisan group that voted it out. We thought we would pass it, finally. And I happened to know some people who were really, really desperate for it to be passed because they were in extremis. And they were there. One woman who'd spent her career as a hospice nurse, so she knew what was going on, and she had stage 4 metastatic lung cancer. She said to them, please, I know what's coming. I know that I'm going to need this legislation. I asked about it recently because the legislation hasn't been passed yet in Connecticut. And I was told, oh yeah, she sold her house and went to another state that has passed it and has established residency and has found the doctors so that when she needs it, she'll be ready. I said, you mean she had to leave her house, leave her neighborhood, leave her support community, her family, and her doctors? That's where we are in order to be able to have the right to be able to exercise this kind of...
Well, you had to die with dignity and grace and without, you know, prolonged suffering.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what it's called. You know, I had a dear friend, an actor whom you may know. His name was René Aubergenois. He and I were in a musical together on Broadway for a year called City of Angels in 1990.
Sure.
René went on to be to have a starring role in one of the Star Trek. I can't tell you which character he played, but but Star Trekkies would know who he is. And he died 2 years ago in December after stage four lung cancer. And his last thing that he dictated to his wife, Judith, who sent it out to all of us, was Renee said, "I'm proud to say that I live in a state in California that recognizes a person's right to die with dignity." So that's what I'm doing, and that's where it came from, and that's why I'm doing it.
Yeah. Well, we learned a lot there. Your activism for this law, I mean, it's important to you personally, right? I mean, it comes out of a desire to not see people have to go through what Pam went through toward the end of her life, right? Or is it that what she could have gone through?
No, that's right. That's right. And in a way, I think I'm sort of honoring her. I've got unfinished business. And I wonder about this myself. I don't really know. But I think sometime, you know, if we can get this passed and if this becomes law, and the governor has said he will sign it, I wonder how it'll feel. I wonder if it'll be a load off. I wonder if it'll feel like, oh, I've been carrying this thing now for 9 years, and there's one I can check off, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's what's going on with me.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. When my son died, trying to find some way to honor him it's something I think about all the time, every day. And it's part of why I'm doing this. It's how I'm here talking to you.
Yeah.
So I understand that feeling completely.
Tell me, how old was he? How old was he when he died?
He was 34 days old. So he was very young. And he had a twin brother who's still, you know, my wife just took him to soccer practice, who's doing phenomenally well, who I love, you know, a real lot.
How old is he?
He is 12.
Oh.
He's 12. He's just about,
yeah.
Everything's just about to change, you know?
I know.
His voice is starting to get deeper. I don't care for it, frankly.
I have a 12-year-old grandson. I know exactly where he is. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I think and you have a son also who I think I've met, right? Is there more than one son? I've met the son, Greg.
I have a son, Greg, and a daughter, Kira.
And I think I've met Kira also at, you know, the way that you and I are connected is through the Hole in the Wall gang camp.
That's right.
Which was Paul Newman's camp for seriously ill children.
Right. Children with life-threatening illnesses, as we say.
That's right.
Yeah. And your dad and I are on the board together and have been for a long, long time.
That's right. And the reason that my family's involved with that is because my brother had cancer as a child.
Yep. Danny.
And it was pretty serious. Danny, that's right.
Danny, yeah. I knew him then as a child at camp.
Well, he's much bigger now. He's...
yeah, I know.
But... I recognize, you know, my dad had cancer when I was younger. My grandfather had cancer. So I recognize a lot of the elements of Pam's journey in their stories. Like, I remember my brother having a port, and I remember, you know, him being home and being on TPN, I think. Is that what it was called? The stuff that was in the bag, that the nutrients that would...
Yeah.
Because he couldn't eat when he was on chemo.
Right.
When Pam was initially diagnosed, was it the kind of thing where you thought... What was your outlook on her illness? Was it the kind of thing where you thought, you know, she's probably going to make it through this? Or from the beginning, were you sort of fearing the worst?
Well, from the moment she told me on the phone that day that they'd found a mass in her pancreas, there was no doubt in my mind that we were in a really, really bad place. And along the way, there were tests, of course, that they had to do. They biopsied the tissue. The doctor actually came out and said to us, that he'd seen the biopsy and he'd done a lot of these biopsies and he didn't think this was going to be a problem. Well, he was exactly wrong. We got people along the way who I think probably they were trying their best to be kind or be positive, but they were just plain wrong. And I thought it was actually kind of irresponsible at the time. Until you get the results, you know, I don't need somebody massaging us and telling us that this is going to be okay because he's seen, he's seen the specimen of the biopsy and it looks okay to him. You know?
Yeah, I think that a false sense of hope is worse, I think, than the hard truth in those times, because it's just farther for you to fall emotionally.
Yeah, it sure doesn't help. It sets you up for another fall. But on the other hand, then there were just some extraordinary doctors that we had along the way, and I'm very close to Pam's oncologist still. In fact, I saw him yesterday. And, you know, you mentioned a port, and the deal with ports is they put a port in so that they can give you what they need to give you, chemo or whatever. And, of course, the port gets infected. And so then they have to take it out of that side of your body and put it over here on this side of your body. And then that port got infected.
Ugh.
And so then they went and they put a pick in her arm. They sew a pick into your arm and it goes up and inside. And then that got infected. And then, you know, and of course, each time that this happened, it was always on a Thursday or a Friday. So you're going into the hospital with an infection. They're going to take out the port. And since nothing happens in a hospital on the weekend, because there aren't any people there in the labs to drop the stuff, to drop the antibiotics into the Petri dish to discover which antibiotic is going to kill that particular bacteria. You sit there over the weekend. So I think we were there 3 weekends in a row, you know, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. Finally, we went home on Tuesday or something. And the third weekend we're there. I came home on Saturday to get some stuff, get Pam another couple of books. She was a voracious reader. Look after the dogs, do whatever you had to do. And then I went back in the evening. I walked into the hospital on Saturday night at about 8 o'clock, and there's our doctor, her oncologist, Dr. Richard Frank in Norwalk Hospital. He's sitting by her bedside. I go, what are you doing here? This is your weekend off. I said, don't you have soccer games and stuff like that, the kids? And he said, yeah. He said, but when I heard that you guys were back in here for the third weekend in a row, I just had to come. You know, so there are people like that.
That for me was also like the things like that were, I mean, obviously so much of it was tragedy, but the one of the nice things about tragedy was seeing how many people stepped up to do things that they did not have to do. Like I remember we talked to a doctor in Wisconsin who I was never going to see. That was never going to be our doctor. I called him up. And he called me back. We talked for 2 hours on the phone. Or like I had a childhood friend who I hadn't seen in years, but whose dad had retained a friendship with my dad, who just showed up at the hospital suddenly while we were at the hospital and just asking us if he could help us out. And I will never forget the people who just kind of cropped up out of no place to be useful.
Yeah.
But especially because there were so many things happening for us emotionally and psychologically that it's like, I can't see straight. So someone else handling this for me is very helpful.
Yeah. Well, there were people, you talk about heroes in the medical industry, in the hospital care faculty. They were just unbelievable. I mean, for the last 2 years now, we've heard about these folks. But I mean, I was there with Pam for 4 years, and it was extraordinary, the number of people who just went way out of their way to try to make her comfortable. And I remember, you know, I don't know how many times you have to learn the same lesson over and over again. You can't judge a book by looking at its cover. So, you know, you get a nurse or some intern, and then you get some sort of a kid whose job it is to come in and change the bed and do something else and make her comfortable. And some of these people, you know, you go, well, you start to, as the husband sitting there next to her, the caregiver, I'm sitting there watching this kid come in. I go, this guy's not going to be any use at all. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, he was the one that came in when she had some sort of a crisis. And he went to the mat. I mean, I was so wrong. You know, I can't tell you the number of times I learned that lesson. But you can't believe what those people do over and over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, for us, that's what my wife became a a pediatric intensive care nurse because of people like that guy going to the mat. We're like, we were in the hospital all the time, and the doctors generally were great, but the nurses were like, you know, the nurses were sitting there crying with us. The nurses were holding our hands.
Yeah.
The nurses changed the way that entire experience went for us. And it was enough that my wife was like, I want to do that.
Well, that's wonderful. I thought at the time, I thought if there are angels on this earth, these are the people who are the angels, the nurses.
Yeah.
They really are, man. They're something.
The way that you, Pam died 9 years ago, is that right?
Yeah, in April, this coming April.
How has the grief that you felt for her death changed in those 9 years? I guess part of what I'm wondering is she was diagnosed and then died 4 years later. So at what point in that do you start to feel the grief of knowing Pam's not going to be around soon? You know what I mean?
Well, you know, it's funny. My job, as I saw it, was to go forward. I mean, to make it happen so that we were going to continue, so I could make it easier for her. I mean, just going to San Antonio every week, you know, that was something that I took on. I was like, okay, I'm going to make the airline reservations. I'm going to get the guy to come and pick us up, drive us to the airport, and pick us up again on 2 days later. When we're there, we're going to stay in the nicest hotel I can find with proximity to the hospital down there. We'd fly down there. We'd get there 9 o'clock on Tuesday night. At 7:30 in the morning, we were walking into the hospital. She'd be in treatment for 4 or 5 hours with chemo, with this experimental new chemo. Then in the afternoon, we'd go home. Oh, we'd have lunch. She'd take a nap. She had to take naps all the time. And I'd figure out where we were going to go to dinner. And the next morning, I'd be down there, make sure we had a car or a service or a cab or something to get us to the airport. So my job was logistics expert and trying to make this thing all kind of go as smoothly as possible. Just, you know, just going to the airport is nerve-wracking for everybody, you know, just going in and out of that. So if I could kind of grease the wheels and figure out the best way to do it and how to get there and the best way to get in and out, that's what I did. When we were here at home, every afternoon or evening, she would be asleep because it took a toll and she needed rest. And so I would spend several hours in the late afternoon going into evening, sitting outside for about eight months a year when the weather was decent, watching the sun go down, watching the night come up. And when the light went on in the bedroom, that meant she was awake. So our night would begin. And it varied depending upon how she was feeling. And I've thought about this, but I spent a lot of nights out there on the backyard. We have a fireplace outside in the back and under the pergola. And I would just spend a lot of hours out there by myself with the dogs, waiting for Pam to wake up. That's a lot of alone time as the lights are getting darker every night. And so I think I spent a lot of time preparing, to answer your question, both consciously and probably a lot more subconsciously, for what was coming down. Because as I said before, when she said, I don't want to wake up anymore, it took me by surprise. And she saw my reaction and she said, well, hey, Jimmy, we always knew this was a fatal disease. So then I looked at her behavior, and during that period of time, she was changing things in the house. She had all the bathrooms done over. You know, we've lived in this house for a long time. I mean, I've lived here now for 45 years, and it's an old 1790s American farmhouse. And we've done everything over a bunch of times. It's my own personal money pit. You know, in the old days, when we first moved in, I was working on Broadway, and I'd be up, you know, sanding Kira's ceiling because it was, you know, the old horsehair reinforced plaster over lath, you know, walls and ceilings, and there were cracks. And I was doing the work and then taping the compound and sanding it all down and painting everything and then cleaning it up at 4 o'clock and taking a shower and jumping in the car and driving to New York City to do a Broadway show and then driving home and the next morning getting up with the kids at breakfast and then bam, up on the ladder and up to the ceiling again. So now I recognized that Pam was, she was making plans for when she wasn't there anymore. She was having the bathrooms done over. She was bringing them up to speed because they, you know, I'd done them over a long time in the 70s. And now it was 2012 and they needed to be brought up to speed. She had a lot of flowers in the backyard and she was taking a lot of those flower beds out and making them into perennials. They weren't annuals anymore. And I asked her about it one point, and she said, well, you're never going to be able to handle all this. So she was doing it. She was making plans. And I was kind of watching and sort of following her lead and kind of being brought up to speed slowly or trying to stay with it, you know. Being aware, but trying, of course, to hold off the inevitable. So that's what was going on during that period of time. And I'll never forget this, Michael. She said to me when it was getting really close, she said, you have to work. You have to work. All right? I went, okay. She said, you have to work. You have to work. And so I did. I thought about the few months after she was gone, and I was trying to learn how to live by myself, shop for myself, cook by myself, do the laundry, all the things that, you know, were shared, that I had shared labors, but I hadn't done them all by myself, and there were an awful lot of stuff I really didn't realize I didn't really know about. And then a few months after that, I sat down and started to put together a musical show. It was a whole musical evening of Randy Newman music. And my agent called Jazz at Lincoln Center and asked if they would like me to, if they'd like to produce me doing a Randy Newman retrospective. And they said yes. And then about a week later, they called and they said, we're going to shoot it for live from Lincoln Center and make a TV show out of it, a TV special, live from Lincoln Center special out of it. So she died in April. I got through the summer with help from my friends and my family and my kids. And then in September 1st, I sat down and started to put the show together. And we went on in January. And the show was over January 28th. And on February 1st, I sat down in the fireplace room in the morning at 8 o'clock and started to learn a one-man play that I performed in that summer up in the Berkshires. So I really worked. I mean, I had to have something that I was really engaged in, and it was very demanding of me to have basically been able to continue to function, I think.
Right.
And did. And she was absolutely right about that too. She wasn't wrong about much of anything that I could think of.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery. Starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I've interviewed people on this podcast. Most people I've interviewed have lost their parents. Some have lost siblings. Mm-hmm. And I've lost my son. And I, but you're the first person I've interviewed on the podcast who has lost a spouse. What, I guess, I'm assuming, have you lost other people in your life, your parents or?
Oh, yeah. My parents, my in-laws, her parents lived to be 98.
Oh, wow.
And her aunt and her grandmother also lived to be 98. And so there was no way that I was ever supposed to survive her. And she had a twin sister. And her twin sister's husband and I were, I loved him and her very much. And we used to all joke, you know, yeah, well, you know, Pascal and I will be gone and Pam and Patty will be out there going to tag sales, you know, until they're 98 years old. And we used to laugh about it, but we really thought that's the way it was going to be. And so this was not supposed to happen. The estate planning that we had done back in the mid-90s was all predicated upon the assumption that she was going to outlive me.
That really? That you would just assume?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That seems like a bleak, any kind of assumption on that level seems a little bit bleak.
Well, you know, we had kids, and Greg graduated from college in 1990, and Kira 3 years later. And so in 95, and we were, you know, we certainly had a will before that. But it was time to sit down and say, okay, how do we want this to roll out if we were to die, or if one of us was to die? So we sat down with a lawyer for a long time and drew up trusts and generation skipping trusts and all that stuff. And of course, it all had to be redone because, you know,
things went the other way.
You know, it's different. I don't think there's anybody who's probably as dependent as a husband, you know. I mean,
my wife would agree.
Yeah. I think that's probably true. I mean, we all lose our parents, but that's what we expect. You know, that's Thornton Wilder would say that's, you know, the way it's supposed to go. And it's terrible when we lose our siblings and our cousins and I think the unkindest cut of all, of course, is to have lost a child. And I had an aunt and uncle who lost a child. When I was young, and I always remember, there's nothing worse. That's the worst. But in terms of creating a totally unable, dependent human being, it's for a husband to lose a wife. I think that's probably the way it goes. But also, you know, we'd been together since we were 17, and we got married at 21, and we had children right away. And so I don't think that I was a whole person. You know, I was half of a whole person, or the two of us together made a whole person. You know, it's just, so it was really difficult. And, you know, if we had lived independently until we were 30 or 35 and then got married, maybe I would have been a more wholly formed individual. But, you know, we grew up together. And I said something to her as she was going, and those last few days, and I said to her, you know, we managed to do everything here. That you're going to leave me in this house that we have lived in at that point for 36, 37 years. And I said, and unlike a lot of my friends, we decided on everything together. I mean, I had friends, you know, who'd go off to work and their wives would decorate the house and they'd come home and they were living with Laura Ashley prints everywhere, you know. Which I wouldn't have found very attractive. But I said, but everything that's here, whatever this style is that we live in, we developed it together. You know, we'd go to the tag sales together, and we'd go to the antique stores together, and we would buy stuff together. And all the decisions that we made were basically made together. So I sure wouldn't want to go anyplace else. It really feels like, and it is, home. That we made here together.
And when she died, what does it feel like to continue making decisions?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm still doing it. we're coming up on 9 years here.
Yeah.
the good news is, I did meet another lady and I married her 4 years ago. And that's been a blessing, a godsend, if there is such a thing as a God or a blessing. But it's been wonderful. And she moved in. And she loves being here too. So it isn't all a sad story. It's been a delight, as a matter of fact. But you know, it doesn't change everything either. It doesn't wipe out the feeling of that I had for Pam. That exists. It coexists. You know, I still think of her all the time. She's still in my dreams. I think of her a lot in relation to our grandchildren, because she was really a baby whisperer, you know, with the grandkids. And they loved her. And they think of her all the time. And in fact, a couple of them are coming to spend the night tomorrow night. And I know that there'll be a question about Baba, because Owen named her Baba when he was just a little baby. And he'd come up the walk and I'd open the door. I'd go, "Hi, Owen." He'd go, "Hi, Poppy, where's Baba?" You know, she was number one. And so that doesn't ever change. And that's a good thing. So she's still around. She's still here. She's in our thoughts and in our lives.
I mean, you've segued into the question I usually ask at the end. I'm going to ask it a little early because you've just brought it up. Do you think of her as being someplace? Mm-hmm. Like, is she in the house? Is she in heaven? I've had people answer all kinds of things to this question.
Yeah, I know. That's a good question. I don't believe in God. I was raised as an Irish Catholic kid, but I somehow, I guess around college age, went away from those things. So I don't believe in any of those things. And I don't go to church. But you know what? It's hard not to think, well, I wonder if she's up there looking down here. I wonder if she's aware. I wonder if she's looking down on us. I hope she is.
Yeah, I understand that so deeply, that same feeling of like, I think all this is kind of fake, but yeah, maybe.
But on the off chance, you know, I do say to her occasionally, you know, well, you know, on the off chance that you're out there somewhere, you know, flying around in space, you got to be happy about, you know, if you can hear me, then you probably know everything. And you know how the kids are doing and you know how the grandkids are doing. And the kids are good. Everybody's good. And so, you know, we're doing the best we can. And so that's got to be making you feel good, you know. But do I really believe that? No. But do I talk to her like that? Yes.
I think that's a thing that a lot of the people who've been on this podcast and people who listen to it can relate to. You know, it's a triumph of wishful thinking over your own beliefs that you're like, well, but maybe she can hear that. Do you actually talk to her? Or are those thoughts in your mind? Or are those words you say out loud?
Well, you know, I mentioned that I spent a lot of hours out there watching the day turn into night. It's magic time, you know. And I spent a lot of nights, a lot of days turning into nights out there watching the day go from blue to gray to silver to dark, and the stars come out and the moon come up, and that time of day is significant to me, I think, for the reasons that I mentioned, because I spent all that time going through that then there with her, or being out there waiting for her to turn the light on. So I think that it, at that time of the evening, I am very sensitive to having thoughts like that. And if I do, if I go out at night, I'm outside in the dark grilling, you know, and I'm looking out looking at the stars and the moon, and it's just hard to, maybe she's up there flying around someplace. It's weird.
Yeah, I agree that it is weird, but it's also very relatable. And it's a thing that I would have dismissed if I hadn't lost my son.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's an idea. I would have people telling me, you know, oh yeah, I think my wife might be flying around the moon, or maybe she's, you know, this red-tailed hawk that keeps landing on my sill. That might be my wife.
Yeah.
Is the kind of thing that before I lost my son, I would have been like, sure, whatever, man.
Yeah, I know.
But now that I feel that emptiness, there's a part of me that's like, but it's crazy to think that could he really just completely be gone? I don't know.
There's that old adage, there are no atheists in foxholes.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, grief is a foxhole for sure.
Yeah.
And it is one of those things. I mean, I don't want to go too far with comparing it to people who've been to war, but it is a thing that, you know, you feel like you can only relate to someone who doesn't know what it's like can only relate to you so much.
Yeah.
But someone who does know, who has been in that particular hole with you, you can have a different kind of conversation with.
Yeah. I mean, I remember there was one incident in particular where when Pam was very, very ill, right near the end, I got a phone call from my agent asking me if I would go in and meet David Hare, who is an English writer and screenwriter and director. And he was going to make this movie, and they really wanted me to go in and meet him. And I said, it's going to be tough for me to do this. And they said, well, you know, it's just you go into the city, you sit down with him for a half an hour, and you go home. Can you? And I said, well, let me see if I can figure this out. So I didn't want to leave her. I didn't want to leave her at all for any length of time. So I called a visiting nurse. I called the Nurses Association, and I had a couple of people that I knew who worked for the Visiting Nurse Association. And I said, I need somebody. I need a real nurse that can come and sub for me for a few hours while I race into the city. So they said, so-and-so, she lives near you, and she just retired, and she'd be great. So I called this woman. She came down. I said, would you come in and sit with me and go through the routine in the morning so that you know where everything is and you know all the things that Pam might need? And she said, sure. So she came down for about 4 hours one morning from 8 o'clock until about noon. And she watched everything and sat with me. And then I said, would you come back tomorrow and you do it and I'll watch you? And she said, yes. And she did that. And I said, okay, tomorrow I'm going to drive into New York City. I'm going to meet David Hare, and I'm going to come home. She said, okay, don't worry about it. It'll be okay. So I raced into I jumped in the car and I raced to the city. And I drove, naturally, the meeting had to be downtown. So I drove all the way downtown. I had figured out a garage that was right there near where his office was. I rolled into the garage, I ran up the stairs, and he was coming out the door and walking down the hall. And I started to talk to him, and he said, come on in. So we had this conversation, and it was a political conversation. I had been listening to NPR, as I always do in the car. And it was a wonderful conversation. And I was just so amped to be racing to try to get it done. I wasn't self-conscious, and I wasn't nervous about meeting him. And we had a great talk for about 45 minutes. And I raced down the stairs, and I jumped in the car, and I raced home, and I raced in the house. And she said, Pam's been asleep the whole time you were gone. You know, she said, you have to keep going forward.
The way you describe it, it sounds like she's giving you a prescription for how to survive the rest of this time.
Yeah, she was. And she updated all the bathrooms, and she got rid of all the annuals and put in the perennials. And so I wouldn't have to, you'll never know how to take care of all that. You know, she was planning for when she wouldn't be able to be here to help me take care of me.
James, were there any moments that you remember from what I'm sure was a generally awful time in those 4 years after her diagnosis? Were there any moments you remember that were like, you know, unexpected joy, or, you know, that were maybe not what someone would expect to hear about a time when things are tragic?
Well, you know, she was, I have to hand it to her, because as I said, all of her friends thought she looked just more beautiful, you know, every day.
That sounds very implausible. I mean, just like,
I know,
knowing people on chemotherapy, someone who looks better on chemo.
I know.
It's something I've never heard anyone say.
I know. It's bizarre. But she did. I mean, as one of her dear friends said, she just looked younger. She kept looking younger, you know. And she was a person who had a really, really incredible smile. People always talked about it. And of course, she smiled all the time. When people came in the room, she smiled. I mean, it got to the point where we have a gym, a workout room. And then you walk down the hall, and then our bedroom was down there. And I switched them because the gym was right closer to the bathroom, so it would be easier for her to get in and out of the bathroom. So we took the bed and all the other stuff and moved it into what had been the gym. And we took all the gym equipment and the weight bench and the bicycles and the ellipticals, and we moved them into the other room. And I went and got a flat screen TV, and we put that up in there. And I had, I don't know, 3,000 slides. You remember photographic slides?
Sure, sure.
From cameras when you were a kid. And I sent them all off to Scan Cafe, and they put them all on thumb drives and on DVD or DVDs, I guess, at the time. And they all came back just about at the same time. So Pam was spending more and more time in bed, and she was in this room, which was nice. We made it into a really kind of commodious place. And I had the flat screen TV in there, and her sisters and her brother or our kids would come, and we'd all hang out together, and we'd have a cocktail party in the bedroom and watch slides from all the home movies that I had, that I had done together. And so
that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was. The timing of it was really great. And I guess that's one of the things that I was busy working on while she was ill. You know, I was trying to get all that stuff together, and it worked out. So she would kind of hold court, you know, and all of the people that she loved most in the world are her family, her siblings, her mom and dad, and our kids and the grandkids would all come, and we'd hang out together, and we'd have a cocktail party and watch slides and home movies. It was great.
That's wonderful. And your kids live. Go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you.
Well, yeah, my son Greg and his wife Kelly. Do you know Kelly?
I haven't met her, but I know her. I mean, just like through.
She's a big Broadway star. Kelly O'Hara is her name.
Yes.
And she, Greg and Kelly have two children, Owen and Charlotte, a boy and a girl, 12 and 8 now. And Kira and her husband, Ben, live in Brooklyn. They have a little boy named Charlie, who's 9. And they were all here. They'd come and hang out, and we'd, you know, spend weeks together or weekends together. And so they were all here at the time. And it was not all, it wasn't doom and gloom. It was, let's make the best out of this while we can. And I have to say, there were a lot of nice times.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Are there things that you feel you have learned from grief? Like, has this process, the process of losing Pam and the time spent after she died, has it taught you anything? Has it changed you?
What's changed is, and I think it's because of this experience that I've been through, I've become an activist. Now I'm testifying about medical aid in dying. Now I'm working on another project, which is to try to get Connecticut to change the way it's funding education in our towns and cities, because it's too dependent upon property taxes. And what that means is that all of our happy, nice, little, tidy, white towns and cities are doing very well. We've all got great school systems in Westport and Weston and Wilton and Greenwich and Darien, all over the place. But we are the richest or among the richest states in the union, and we've got the three poorest cities in the United States, Bridgeport, New Haven, and Hartford. And the amount of money per pupil that is being spent to educate a kid in Bridgeport is about $13,000. And in Westport and Weston and Wilton, it's about $23,000. And in Canaan, Connecticut, it's $33,000.
Wow.
And the state Supreme Court found that, in fact, Connecticut was not living up to the Constitution. The Constitution says that every child's due an equitable education. Well, there's nothing equitable if you're getting $13,000 and the other guy's getting $25,000, right? So I said, this is an issue that I want to get behind. I got to get medical aid in dying done first, and then we got to do something about this one.
You're a busy man.
These are all really important issues, and that's what it takes. Well, what is it that's motivating me? Well, I think it has to do with the fact that something inside me has been turned on or turned around. It comes from having been touched in a particularly meaningful way by this experience that I have lived through, by the pain that I felt, by wanting to do what Pam told me to do, which was to work, to work at something. I mean, I sound like a raving maniac, but I'm really serious.
I don't think so. I don't think you do at all.
I'm really serious about it. And I got to tell you, I mean, I'm motivated. I'm in there trying to get stuff done.
Well, I think you talk about when you were taking care of Pam and how your job felt like it was moving forward, and it seemed like you gave yourself like lots of projects and things to do, tangible things that you could work on to move forward. Now that she's gone, it seems like those projects are just getting bigger. You're moving more forward. It's a lot.
Yeah, I got motivated during that period of time, and now I got to find projects to keep me going, to satisfy my hunger for accomplishment.
James, on the issue of medical aid for dying, is there someplace that people who listen to this podcast can turn to assist with that? Are you raising money, or what do we do here?
Yes, there is. Call or write or email or do all three to find out who your state senator is and find out who your state representative is and write to them or call the office. And all you got to do, I think, is go to somethingconnecticut.gov. I should know what this is.
That's okay. My producer's looking it up right now, and she says it's cga.ct.gov. And we're also going to throw it in the episode description.
Yes, thanks. And you can get their phone numbers. You can find out what district you're in and who your representative is. Write to them. Say, this is an important issue. I want this to get passed. You can't let this, when it comes up again this year, go by the wayside. These guys are really responsive. I have a friend who's a state senator. He says, if I get five phone calls about something, he said, that really gets my attention.
Yeah.
So, that's what people can do. And as I said, 75% of us in the state want it. That's a lot. You know, we've got 50.5% in the Connecticut Senate, in the U.S. Senate, and that's not very much. And we know what that's costing us. But 75% of Connecticut residents want this legislation. And some of us want it really badly. So I hope we can get it done, and with people's cooperation. And you can call your friends. Those of you who are listening out there, you can call your friends and say, hey, here's the guy. Here's our guy. Let's hit him with a whole bunch of letters and tell him we don't want him just to be a yes vote. We want him to be an advocate among his peers. Go out and get the other guys that you're sitting on these boards with and say, come on, let's get this done for the people.
I love that, James. I think it's a worthy cause, and it's also a great tribute to Pam. I mean, it's a way for her to live on in something that's, bigger than any one of us.
Well, thanks, Michael. Thanks for the conversation. Thanks for the opportunity to get up on my soapbox.
Thank you for doing this. This was another episode of A Good Cry with James Naughton. Thanks for listening, and I hope it helps. Hello, friends. Michael Cruz Kane here again to tell you a couple things. One, you can see me live in Manhattan on February 24th at Fotografiska, a beautiful photography museum. I'm there with Chris Gethard, who you might know from HBO's Career Suicide, from his podcast Beautiful Anonymous, and also from being my friend. And then there's Rebecca Sofer, who is one of the co-founders of Modern Loss, and she's an author and blah, blah, blah. She's amazing. We'll be talking about grief. The link to tickets for that event is in the description of this episode. And then the other thing I wanted to say is thank you so much for subscribing and rating and reviewing the podcast. You can never do it enough. Open a new account and do it with that also. I don't know. Is that illegal? I say just do it. Thank you so much. And also to the people who message me, I love you and appreciate you so much. Keep doing it. The email is agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. Okay, bye. See you soon. A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mattan.
That was a HeadGum podcast.